told the story again. He recorded me, but didn't say a thing about the drug charge. When I asked Lonnie about it later, he said the deal had been worked out between Fitchner and Burkhead, not to worry. Lonnie and I were fighting, mainly about the drugs. I've been clean and sober for 14 years now, Mr. Post.
That's wonderful. Congratulations.
Buck got me through it.
Buck said, I like my beer, but I always stayed away from drugs. I knew my daddy would shoot me.
Anyway, they took me to Butler County for the trial, and I testified. I felt rotten about it, but I really didn't want to spend a lot of time in jail. I figured it was either me or Quincy Miller, and I've always been loyal to me. Every dog for himself, you know. Over the years, I've tried to forget about the trial. That young lawyer made a fool out of me.
Tyler Townsend?
That's him. I'll never forget him.
And then you left town?
Yes, sir. As soon as the trial was over, Fitchner called me to his office, thanked me, gave me $1,000 in cash, and told me to get lost. Said if I came back to Florida within 5 years, he'd have me arrested for lying to the jury. Can you believe that? A deputy drove me to Gainesville and put me on the bus to Atlanta. Never been back and don't want to go. I didn't even tell my friends where I was. Didn't have many. It was an easy place to leave.
Buck wants some credit and says, when she first told me about this a few weeks ago, I said, you got to tell the truth, babe. That man's been locked up because of you. There's still a drug charge on your record, I say.
That was the first one a year before.
You should get it expunged.
I know, but it was a long time ago. Buck and I are doing okay these days. We both work hard and pay our bills. I don't really want to be bothered with the past, Mr. Post.
If she signs the affidavit, can they get her for perjury in Florida? Buck asks. No, the statute of limitations has run out. Besides, no one really cares anymore. There's a new sheriff, new prosecutor, new judge.
When will all this happen?
She asks, obviously relieved now that she's told the truth. It's a slow process. Could take months or years if it happens at all. First, you have to sign the affidavit. She'll sign it, Buck says, then takes another bite. With his mouth full, he adds, won't you, babe?
I gotta think about it, she says.
Buck says, look, if we have to go to Florida, then I'll drive you down there and punch anybody who causes trouble. There will be no trouble, I can assure you. The only downside for you, Carrie, is telling your sons. The rest of your family and your friends will probably never know. If Quincy Miller walked out of prison tomorrow, who in Kingsport, Tennessee, would hear about it? Buck nods in agreement and takes another bite. Carrie picks up another fry. Buck says, they're good boys, her two. I got a couple of wild ones, but Carrie's are fine boys. Hell, like you say, I'll bet they'll be proud of you, babe. She smiles, but I'm not sure she's convinced. Buck, my new ally, is confident. I finish my eggs and begin prodding her about the drug scene in Seabrook back then. Cocaine and pot were their preferred choices, and Lonnie always had a supply. Their romance was on and off, and she did not spend time with the other deputies, though some were known to deal in small quantities. She claims she knew nothing about Fitchner's alleged role in the trade. When the table is cleared, I ask for the check. I graciously thank them and offer my admiration for her courage in coming forward. I promise not to prepare the affidavit until she makes up her mind. We say goodbye in the parking lot, and I watch them drive away. I return to the restaurant and walk to our table to fetch a baseball cap I deliberately left behind. When no one is looking, I swap the salt and pepper shakers with two from my pocket. 3 miles down the road, I exit the interstate and pull into the parking lot of a shopping center. Seconds later, Frankie wheels in, parks next to me, and gets into the front seat, all smiles. He holds a small recorder and says, "Clear as a bell." This can be a dirty business. We are forced to deal with witnesses who have lied, police who have fabricated evidence, experts who have misled juries, and prosecutors who have suborned perjury. We, the good guys, often find that getting our hands dirty is the only way to save our clients. If Carrie Holland Pruitt refuses to cooperate and sign an affidavit, then I'll find a way to get her statements into the court record. I've done it before. Chapter 15. Our hands get even dirtier. Frankie has hired an investigator out of Birmingham to stalk Mark Carter, the man who raped and murdered Emily Brune. He lives in the small town of Bayless, 10 miles from Verona, where Duke Russell was convicted. Carter sells tractors for a dealer in Verona, and he ends most workdays at a dive, where he meets some buddies for a few beers and pool. He is at a table drinking Bud Light from a bottle when a man stumbles and crashes into the little party. Bottles fly as beer is spilled. The man gets to his feet, apologizing profusely, and the situation is tense for a moment. He scoops up the half-empty bottles, buys another round, and keeps apologizing. He sets 4 fresh bottles on the table and cracks a joke. Carter and his pals finally laugh. All is well as the man, our investigator, retreats to a corner and pulls out his cell phone. In a coat pocket, he has the beer bottle Carter was working on. The next day, Frankie drives it to a lab in Durham and hands it over, along with a single pubic hair we filched from the police evidence file. Guardian pays $6,000 for an expedited test. The results are beautiful. We now have DNA proof linking Carter to the rape and murder. At Duke's trial, 7 pubic hairs were entered into evidence by the state of Alabama. They were supposedly collected from the crime scene, from Emily's body. Duke submitted samples of his own. With great certainty, the state's expert testified that they matched those found on the corpse, overwhelming proof that Duke raped Emily before he strangled her. Another expert testified that he also bit her several times during the assault. There was no semen found in or around her body. Undaunted by this, the prosecutor, Chad Fallwright, simply told the jury that Duke had probably just used a condom. There was no proof of this. One was never found. But this made perfect sense to the jury. To get a death verdict, Fallwright had to prove murder plus rape. The victim was naked and had probably been sexually assaulted, but the proof was weak. The pubic hairs became crucial evidence. In a sober moment, Duke's lawyer asked the court for money to hire his own expert hair analyst. The court said no. The lawyer either knew nothing about DNA testing or didn't want to bother with it. He may have assumed the court would not authorize it. Thus, the 7 pubic hairs were never tested. But they were certainly analyzed. The expert testimony sent Duke to death row, and 3 months ago came within 2 hours of getting him killed. Now we have the truth. Verona sits in the center of the state, in a desolate, sparsely populated flatland packed with piney woods. For its 5,000 inhabitants, a good job is driving a pulpwood truck, a bad one is sacking groceries. 1 in 5 has no job at all. It's a depressing place, but then most of my stops are in towns that time has passed by. Chad Fallwright's office is in the courthouse, just down the dusty hallway from where Duke was convicted 9 years ago. I've been here once before and would prefer to avoid it in the future. This meeting will not be pleasant, but I'm accustomed to that. Most prosecutors despise me, and the sentiments are mutual. As agreed upon, I arrive at 1:58 p.m. and give a nice smile to Chad's secretary. It's obvious she does not like me either. He's busy, of course, and she invites me to have a seat under a dreadful portrait of a scowling and hopefully dead judge. 10 minutes pass as she pecks away at a keyboard. There are no sounds coming from his office. 15 minutes. After 20 minutes, I say rudely, "Look, we made an appointment for 2 p.m. I drove a long way to get here. Now what the hell is going on?" She glances at an old desk phone and says, "He's still talking to the judge." "Does he know I'm out here?" I demand loud enough for him to hear. "Yes. Now, please." I sit down, wait 10 more minutes, then walk to his door and knock loudly. Before he or she can say anything, I barge in and find Chad not on the phone, but at his window as if enthralled by the vibrant city below. "We agreed on 2 o'clock, Chad. What the hell?" "Sorry, Post, I was on the phone with the judge. Come on in." "Don't mind if I do. I drove 5 hours to get here." "A little courtesy would be nice." "My apologies," he says sarcastically, and falls into his large leather swivel. He's about my age and has spent the last 15 years prosecuting criminals, primarily cookers and peddlers of meth. By far his most thrilling case was Emily's murder. 3 months ago, as the clock ticked, he chased every TV reporter within sight and chatted about the burdens of his job. "No problem," I say, and take a seat. "What's on your mind?" he asks and glances at his watch. "We've done some DNA testing," I say, and manage to maintain my sour expression. What I want to do is get in his face with some serious smack. "We know who the real killer is, Chad, and it ain't Duke Russell." He takes it well.
"Do tell."
"Do tell." We obtained a sample from the killer and matched it with one of the state's pubic hairs. "Bad news, Chad. You got the wrong man."
"You tampered with our evidence?"
"Brilliant. You're more concerned with my sins than with your own. You almost executed an innocent man, Chad. Don't worry about me. I'm just the guy who's found the truth."
"How did you steal a pubic hair?"
"It was easy. You gave me the file, remember? A year ago, down the hall. For 2 days, I sweated in that cramped little room and went through the evidence. One pubic hair stuck to my finger. A year has passed, and no one here has even realized it."
"You stole a pubic hair? Unbelievable!"
"Didn't steal it, Chad. I just borrowed it." "You refused DNA testing, so somebody had to do it. Indict me. I don't care. You have bigger problems right now." He exhales as his shoulders sag. A minute passes as he collects his thoughts. Finally,
"Okay. Who killed her?"
"The last man seen with her before she was murdered, Mark Carter. They had a history from high school. The cop should have pursued him, but didn't for some reason."
"How do you know it's him?"
"Got a sample."
"How?"
"A beer bottle. He likes beer. Leaves behind a lot of bottles. We ran to the lab, and I've brought you a copy of the test results."
"You stole a beer bottle, too?"
"Indict me again, Chad, and keep playing games. Look in the mirror, man, and give it up. Your bogus prosecution is going down the drain, and you're about to be humiliated." He offers a goofy grin and gives me a prosecutor's favorite line.
"No way, Post. I still believe in my case."
"Then you're an idiot, Chad, but we knew that a long time ago. I toss a copy of the report on his desk and head for the door.
Wait a minute, Post, he says. Let's finish the conversation. Assuming you're telling the truth here, what's next?
I sit down calmly and crack my knuckles. Duke will get out earlier if I can persuade Chad to cooperate. If he fights me, which prosecutors usually do, then the exoneration will take months instead of weeks. Here's the best way out of this, Chad, and I'm not going to argue strategy here. For a change, I'm holding all the cards. There are 6 other pubic hairs. Let's get them tested too, so we'll know a lot more. If all 7 exclude Duke, then he walks. If all 7 nail Carter, then you have a new case on your hands. If you agree to the additional testing, then things will go smooth. If you block it, then I'll file in state court, probably lose, then go to federal court. Eventually, I'll get the testing done, and you know it. Reality sets in, and he's angry. He pushes his chair back and walks to the window, deep in thought. He breathes heavily, rolls his head around as his neck crackles, strokes his chin. What all of this produces should surprise me, but it doesn't. Not anymore. He says, "You know, Post, I can see both of them there with Emily, taking turns." "You can't see the sky, Chad, because you don't want to." I stand and walk to the door. "I believe in my case, Post." "Here's the plan, Chad. You have 2 weeks. If you're still delusional in 2 weeks, I'll file my motion for testing, and I'll also sit down with Jim Bisco at the Birmingham News. As you know, he's covered the case, and we're acquaintances. When I tell him about the DNA, you'll be front page news, and it won't be the headlines you dream about. Between Bisco and myself, we can paint you as one enormous fool, Chad. Won't be that hard." I open the door and leave. My last image of Chad is him standing at the window, gawking at me, stunned, mouth breathing, thoroughly defeated. I wish I could have taken a photo. I leave Verona in a hurry and settle in for the long drive to death row. Duke doesn't know about the DNA results. I want to tell him in person. Our meeting will be a wonderful occasion. Chapter 16. There is no urgent need for me to visit Seabrook. All of the players in Quincy's trial have either died, retired, fled, or disappeared under mysterious circumstances. I have no idea who I'm supposed to be afraid of, but there is a palpable sense of fear. So I send Frankie on reconnaissance. He spends 2 days and 2 nights there, moving through the shadows as only he can do. His verbal report is typically blunt.
"Ain't much to it, boss."
He leaves and drives several hours to Deerfield Beach, near Boca Raton. He roams the streets, works the internet, scopes out locations, and in short order puts on a handsome suit and makes the call. Tyler Townsend agrees to meet him at a new shopping center his company is finishing. Big signs announce plenty of space to lease. Frankie claims he and a partner are looking at prime spots for a sporting goods store. It's a new company, one with no presence online. Tyler seems friendly enough, but a bit wary. He's 50 now, and he left the law a long time ago. A good move. He's prospered in South Florida real estate and knows his business. He and his wife have 3 teenagers in their spacious home. Property taxes on it were $58,000 last year. He drives a fancy import and dresses and looks like money. Frankie's ruse doesn't last long. They step into a 4,000-square-foot space with drying plaster, and Tyler asks, "Now, what was the name of your company?"
"No name, no company." I'm here under false pretenses. But it's still important. Are you a cop? Anything but. I'm an ex-con who spent 14 years in a Georgia prison for somebody else's murder. A young lawyer took my case and proved I was innocent. Got me exonerated. And dear old Georgia forked over some cash. My record is clean. From time to time, I work for the lawyer. Figure it's the least I can do. Is this by chance related to Quincy Miller? It is. The lawyer now represents him. We know he's innocent, as do you. He gives a deep breath and actually smiles. But only for a moment. He walks to a large front window and Frankie follows him. They watch an asphalt crew pave the parking lot. Tyler asks, "And your name?" "Frankie Tatum." He hands over a Guardian business card, and Tyler examines both sides. He asks, "So how's Quincy doing?" "It's been 22 years. I did only 14 as an innocent man. Somehow managed to keep my sanity. But every day is another nightmare." Tyler hands the card back, as if he's removing the evidence. "Look, I really don't have time for any of this. I don't know what you want, but I'm not getting involved, okay? Sorry and all that, but Quincy is a closed chapter in my book." "You were a hell of a lawyer, Tyler. You were just a rookie, but you fought for Quincy."
He smiles, shrugs, and says, "And I lost. I'll ask you to leave now."
"Sure, your property and all. My boss is a lawyer named Cullen Post. Check him out. He's exonerated 8 people, and he didn't do that by taking no for an answer. He wants to talk to you, Tyler. Somewhere private. Very private. Believe me, Tyler, Post knows the game, and he ain't going away. You can save a lot of time and trouble if you'll just meet with him for 15 minutes.
"And he's in Savannah?"
"No. He's across the street."
Frankie points in my direction. The three of us walk around the corner to a family-style restaurant that Tyler's company is building. It's unfinished and workers are taking chairs out of boxes. The avenue beyond is choked with new buildings, car dealerships, fast food huts and drive-thrus, strip malls, a car wash, gas stations, a couple of branch banks. Florida sprawl at its finest. We stand in a corner, away from the workers, and Tyler says, "Okay, let's have it." I get the impression that this conversation may end abruptly, so I ditch the small talk with, "Is it possible to prove Quincy is innocent?" He considers this and shakes his head. "Look, I'm not getting involved in this. Years ago, I tried my best to prove his innocence, and I failed. That was another life. Now I have 3 kids, a beautiful wife, money, no worries. I'm not going back there. Sorry."
"Where's the danger, Tyler?"
"Oh, you'll find out. I mean, I hope not, for your sake anyway. But you're walking into a bad situation, Mr. Post." "All of my cases are bad situations." He grunts as if I have no idea. "Nothing like this." "We're about the same age, Tyler. And we quit the law at the same time because we were disillusioned. My second career didn't exactly work, and then I found a new calling. I spend my time pounding the streets, looking for a break, looking for help. Right now, Tyler, Quincy needs your help." He takes a deep breath and has had enough. "I suppose you have to be pushy in your line of work, but I'm not getting pushed, Mr. Post. Good day. Leave me alone and don't come back." He turns around and walks out the door. Not surprisingly, Chad Fallwright digs in. He will not agree to DNA testing of the other 6 pubic hairs. He now has them under lock and key, along with the other evidence.
and to show what a tough prosecutor he really is, he's threatening to have me indicted for tampering. Alabama prohibits it, as do all states, though with varying penalties, and he gleefully writes that I could face up to a year in jail. Locked up over one lousy pubic hair. In addition, he says he plans to file ethics complaints against me with the Alabama and Georgia Bar Associations. I laugh at this. I've been threatened before, and by far more creative prosecutors. Mazie prepares a thick petition for post-conviction relief. Procedurally, it has to be filed first in state court in Verona. The day before we file it, I drive to Birmingham and meet with Jim Bisco, a veteran reporter who covered Duke's trial. He followed the case as the appeals dragged on and expressed doubts about the fairness of the trial. He was especially harsh with his criticism of Duke's defense lawyer. When the poor guy died of cirrhosis, Jim covered it and suggested that another investigation into the murder would be appropriate. He is delighted by the news that the DNA testing has cleared Duke. I'm careful not to name Mark Carter as the killer. That will come later. The day after we filed the petition, Bisco runs a lengthy article that lands on the front page of the Metro section. Chad Fallwright is quoted as saying, "I remain confident that we got the right man, and I'm working diligently to bring about the execution of Duke Russell, a ruthless killer. DNA testing means nothing in this case." After two more conversations with Otis Walker, both by phone, Frankie is convinced that June Walker wants nothing to do with Quincy Miller. Obviously, their chaotic divorce left permanent scars, and she is adamant in her determination not to get involved. There's nothing in it for her except bad memories and the embarrassment of confronting old lies. Otis warns Frankie to leave them alone. He promises to do so. For now. Chapter 17. There are 23 lawyers working in Seabrook these days, and we have a thin file on each of them. About half were in town when Russo was murdered. The senior barrister is a 91-year-old gentleman who still drives himself to the office every day. Two rookies showed up last year and hung out a shingle. All are white, six are female. The most prosperous appear to be a couple of brothers who've spent 20 years doing bankruptcies. Most of the local bar seems to be barely hanging on, same as in most small towns. Glenn Colacurchy once served in the Florida Senate. His district covered Ruiz County and two others, and he was in his third term at the time of the murder. Keith Russo was a distant relative. Both came from the same Italian neighborhood in Tampa. In his younger years, Colacurchy ran the biggest law firm in town and hired Keith out of law school. When he showed up in Seabrook, he brought a wife with him, but Colacurchy had no position for her. Keith didn't last long, and a year later, the Russo firm was founded in a two-room walk-up above a bakery on Main Street. I select Colacurchy because his file is slightly thicker and because he'll probably know more about Keith. Of all the active lawyers in town, he'll have a better recollection of history. On the phone, he says he can spare half an hour. Driving through Seabrook for the first time, I feel as though I know the place. There are not that many points of interest: the office building once owned by Keith and Diana, and the place where the crime occurred, the street behind it where Carrie Holland claimed to have seen a black man making his escape, the courthouse. I park across from it on Main Street and sit and watch the languid foot traffic. I wonder how many of these people remember the murder. How many knew Keith Russo, Quincy Miller? Do they know the town got it wrong and sent an innocent man to prison? Of course not. When it's time, I join them on the sidewalk and go half a block to the office.
In thick black letters of peeling paint, the sign on the window say Colakirchie Law Firm. An old bell jingles on the door as I step inside. An ancient tabby cat slides off a sofa and disturbs a layer of dust. To my right is a roll-top desk with a manual Underwood typewriter, as if just waiting for a gray-haired secretary to return and resume pecking away. The smell is of old leather and stale tobacco, not altogether unpleasant, but begging for a good cleaning. Remarkably, though, in the midst of an earlier century, a stunning young Asian woman in a short skirt appears with a smile and says,
"Good morning. May I help you?"
I return the smile and say, "Yes, I'm Cullen Post. I talked to Mr. Colakirchie yesterday, and we agreed to meet this morning." She manages to grin and frown at the same time as she steps to a slightly more modern desk. Quietly, she says,
"He didn't tell me. Sorry. My name is B."
"Is he here?" I ask.
"Sure, I'll get him. He's not that busy."
She smiles again and glides away. A moment later, she waves me back, and I enter the big office where Glenn has held court for decades. He is standing by his desk as if pleased to have a visitor, and we go through quick introductions. He motions to a leather sofa and says to B,
"Fetch us some coffee, please."
He hobbles on a cane to a chair that would hold two people. He's almost 80 and certainly looks it, with extra weight and white beard and a mass of unkempt white hair in bad need of a trimming. At the same time, he looks sort of dapper with a pink bow tie and red suspenders.
"Are you a priest or something?"
he asks, staring at my collar. "Yes, Episcopal." I give him the quick version of Guardian Ministries. As I talk, he rests his fuzzy chin on the grip of his cane and absorbs every word with piercing green, though apparently bloodshot, eyes. B brings the coffee, and I take a sip. Lukewarm, probably instant. When she leaves and closes the door, he asks,
"What exactly is a priest doing, sticking his nose into an old case like Quincy Miller?"
Great question. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think he is innocent. This amuses him.
"Interesting," he mumbles. "I've never had a problem with Miller's conviction. There was an eyewitness, as I remember."
"There were no witnesses. A young woman named Carrie Holland testified she saw a black man running away from the scene, carrying what was implied to have been a shotgun. She lied. She was a druggie who cut a deal with the authorities to avoid jail. She has now admitted she lied, and she wasn't the only liar at trial." He takes his fingers and sweeps back his long hair. It's oily and appears to be unwashed.
"Interesting.
Were you close to Keith?" A grunt in frustration and half a smile.
"What do you want from me?"
"Just background. Did you watch the trial?"
"No. Wanted to, but they moved it next door to Butler County. I was in the Senate back then and pretty busy. Had 7 lawyers working around here. Biggest firm in these parts. And I couldn't exactly spend my time sitting in a courtroom watching other lawyers."
"Keith was a relative, right?"
"Sort of. Quite distant. I knew his people down in Tampa. He pestered me for a job, and I gave him one. But he never fit. He wanted me to hire his wife, too, but I didn't want to. He hung around here for a year or so, then struck out on his own. I didn't like that. Italians place a premium on loyalty."
"Was he a good lawyer?"
"Why is that important now?"
"Just curious. Quincy says that Keith did a terrible job handling his divorce, and the court file tends to support this. The prosecutor played up their conflict to prove motive, which is kind of a stretch. I mean, a client is so disgruntled he blows off in his lawyer's face.
Never happened to me,
he says and roars with laughter. I gamely laugh along.
But I've had my share of crazy clients. Had a guy show up one time with a gun, years ago, pissed off over a divorce. At least he said he had a gun. Every lawyer in the building had a weapon, and it could have been ugly, but a cute little secretary calmed him down. I've always believed in cute secretaries.
Old lawyers would rather tell war stories than eat lunch, and I would like nothing better than to get him cranked up. I say, you had a big firm back then.
Big for this part of the state. 7, 8, sometimes 10 lawyers, a dozen secretaries, offices upstairs, clients lined up out the front door. It was pretty crazy back in those days, but I got tired of all the drama. I spent half my time refereeing my employees. You ever practiced?
I'm practicing now. Just a different specialty. Years ago, I worked as a public defender but burned out. I found God, and He led me to the seminary. I became a minister, and through an outreach program, met an innocent man in prison. That changed my life.
You get him out?
I did. Then 7 more. I'm working on 6 cases now, including Quincy's.
I read somewhere that maybe 10% of all people locked up are innocent. You believe that?
10% might be on the high side, but there are thousands of innocent people in prison.
I'm not sure I believe that.
Most white folks don't. But go to the black community and you'll find plenty of believers. In his 18 years in the state Senate, Colakirchie voted consistently on the side of law and order, pro-death penalty, pro-gun rights, a real drug warrior, and big spender for whatever the state police and prosecutors wanted. He says,
I never had the stomach for criminal law. Can't make any money there.
But Keith made money on the criminal side, didn't he? He glares at me with a frown, as if I've stepped out of bounds. Eventually, he says,
Keith's been dead for over 20 years. Why are you so interested in his law practice?
Because my client didn't kill him. Someone else did. Someone with a different motive. We know Keith and Diana were representing drug dealers in the late 80s, had some clients in the Tampa area. Those guys make good suspects.
Maybe. But I doubt if they'll do much talking after all these years.
Were you close to Sheriff Fitzner? He glares at me again. In a not-so-subtle way, I've just linked Fitzner to the drug dealers, and Colakirchie knows where I'm fishing. He takes a deep breath, exhales loudly, says,
Bradley and I were never close. He ran his show, I ran mine. We were both after the same votes, but we dodged each other. I didn't mess with the criminal side, so our paths seldom crossed.
Where is he now? I asked.
Dead, I presume. He left here years back.
He's not dead, but living a good life in the Florida Keys. He retired after 32 years as sheriff and moved away. His 3-bedroom condo in Marathon is assessed at $1.6 million. Not a bad retirement for a public servant who never earned more than $60,000 a year.
You're thinking Fitzner was somehow involved with Keith?
He asks. Oh, no. Didn't mean to imply that. Oh, yes. But Colakirchie is not taking the bait. He narrows his eyes and says,
This eyewitness, she says Fitzner convinced her to lie on the stand.
If and when Carrie Holland recants her false testimony, it will be included in a court filing for everyone to see. However, I'm not ready to reveal anything to this guy. I say, Look, Mr. Colakirchie, this is all confidential, right?
Of course,
he readily agrees. He was a stranger until about 15 minutes ago, and he'll probably be on the phone before I get to my vehicle. She didn't name Fitzer, just said it was the cops and prosecutor. I have no reason to suspect Fitzner of anything.
That's good. This murder was solved 20 years ago. You're spinning your wheels, Mr. Post.
Maybe. How well did you know Diana Russo? He rolls his eyes as if she was the last subject he wants to discuss.
Not well at all. I kept my distance from the beginning. She wanted a job, but back then we didn't hire girls. She took it as an insult and never liked me. She soured Keith on me, and we never got along. I was relieved when he left, though I wasn't finished with him. He became a real pain in the ass.
In what way? He gazes at the ceiling, as if debating whether or not to tell me a story. Being an old lawyer, he can't help himself.
Well, this is what happened,
he begins as he shifts weight and settles in for the narrative.
Back in the day, I had all the tort business sewed up in Ruiz County. All the good car wrecks, bad products, med mal, bad faith, everything. If a person got injured, they showed up here, or sometimes I went to see them in the hospital. Keith wanted some of the action because it's no secret that injuries are the only way to make money out there on the streets. Big firm guys in Tampa do okay, but nothing like big tort lawyers. When Keith left my office, he stole a case, took it with him, and we had one hell of a fight. He was broke and needed the cash, but the case belonged to my firm. I threatened to sue him, and we fought for 2 years. He eventually agreed to give me half the fee. But there was bad blood. Diana was in the middle of it, too.
Law firms blow up every week, and it's always over money. Did you and Keith ever reconcile?
Sort of, I guess. But it took years. It's a small town, and the lawyers generally get along. We had lunch the week before he was murdered, and had a laugh or two. Keith was a good boy who worked hard. Maybe a bit too ambitious. I never warmed up to her, though. But you had to feel sorry for her. Poor girl found her husband with his face blown off. Handsome guy, too. She took it hard, never recovered. Sold the building and eventually left town.
No contact since then?
None whatsoever.
He glances at his watch as if he's facing another hectic day, and the hint is clear. We wind down the conversation, and after 30 minutes, I thank him and leave. Chapter 18. Bradley Fitzner ruled the county for 32 years before retiring. During his career, he avoided scandal and ran a tight operation. Every 4 years, he was either unopposed or faced light opposition. He was succeeded by a deputy who served 7 years before bad health forced him out. The current sheriff is Wink Castle, and his office is in a modern metal building that houses all local law enforcement, sheriff, city police, and jail. A dozen brightly painted patrol cars are parked in front of the building at the edge of town. The lobby is busy with cops and clerks and sad relatives checking on inmates. I'm led to Castle's office, and he greets me with a smile and firm handshake. He's about 40 and has the easy manner of a rural politician. He did not live in the county at the time of the Russo murder, so hopefully he carries no baggage from those days. After a few minutes of weather talk, he says,
"Quincy Miller, huh? I looked through the file last night to get up to speed. Are you a priest or something?"
"A lawyer and a minister," I say, and spend a moment talking about Guardian. "I take old cases that involve the innocent."
"Good luck with this one."
I smile and say, "They're all difficult, Sheriff."
"Got it. So how do you plan to prove that your client did not kill Keith Russo?"
"Well, as always, I go back to the scene and start digging. I know that most of the state's witnesses lied at trial. The evidence is shaky at best.
Zeke Huffy.
Typical jailhouse snitch. I found him in prison in Arkansas, and I expect him to recant. He's made a career out of lying and recanting. Not unusual for those guys. Carrie Holland has already told me the truth. She lied under pressure from Fitzner and Burkhead, the prosecutor. They gave her a good deal on a pending drug charge. After the trial, Fitzner gave her $1,000 and ran her out of town. She hasn't been back. June Walker, Quincy's ex-wife, lives in Tallahassee but so far has refused to cooperate. She testified against Quincy and lied because she was angry over their divorce. Lots of lies, Sheriff. This is all new to him, and he absorbs it with interest. Then he shakes his head and says, "Still a long way to go. There's no murder weapon." Right. Quincy never owned a shotgun. The key, obviously, is the blood-spattered flashlight that mysteriously disappeared not long after the murder. "What happened to it?" he asks. He's the sheriff. I should be asking him. "You tell me." The official version, according to Fitzner, is that it was destroyed in a fire where they kept evidence.
"You doubt that?"
"I doubt everything, Sheriff. The expert for the state, a Mr. Norwood, never saw the flashlight. His testimony was pretty outrageous." I reach into my briefcase, pull out some papers, and place them on his desk. "This is our summary of the evidence. In there you'll see a report from a Dr. Kyle Benderschmidt, a renowned criminologist, that raises serious doubts about Norwood's testimony. Have you looked at the photographs of the flashlight?"
"Yes."
"Dr. Benderschmidt believes that the specks, or flecks, on the lens are probably not even human blood. And the flashlight was not found at the scene. We're not sure where it came from, and Quincy swears he had never seen it." He takes the report and takes his time flipping through it. When he gets bored, he tosses it onto his desk and says,
"I'll spend some time with it tonight. What exactly do you want me to do here?"
"Help me. I'll file a petition for post-conviction relief based on new evidence. It will have reports from our experts and statements from the witnesses who lied. I need for you to reopen the investigation into the murder. It will be a tremendous help if the court knows that the locals believe the wrong man was convicted."
"Come on, Mr. Post. This case was closed over 20 years ago, long before I came to town."
"They're all old cases, Sheriff, old and cold. That's the nature of our work. Most of the actors are gone. Fitzner, Burkhead, even the judge is dead. You can look at the case with a fresh perspective and help get an innocent man out of prison." He's shaking his head.
"I don't think so. I can't see getting involved in this. Hell, I never thought about the case until you called yesterday."
"All the more reason to get involved. You can't be blamed for anything that went wrong 20 years ago. You'll be seen as the good guy trying to do the right thing."
"Do you have to find the real killer to get Miller out?"
"No. I have to prove him innocent, that's all. In about half of our cases, we manage to nail the real criminal, but not always." He keeps shaking his head. The smiles are gone.
"I can't see it, Mr. Post. I mean,
you expect me to pull one of my overworked detectives off his active cases and start digging through a 20-year-old murder that folks around here have forgotten about. Come on, man."
"I'll do the heavy lifting, Sheriff. That's my job."
"So what's my job?"
"Cooperate. Don't get in the way." He leans back in his chair and locks his hands behind his head. He stares at the ceiling as minutes pass. Finally, he asks,
"In your cases, what do the locals normally do?"
"Cover up, stonewall, hide evidence, fight me like hell, contest everything I file in court. You see, Sheriff, in these cases, the stakes are too high and the mistakes are too egregious for anyone to admit they were wrong. Innocent men and women serve decades while the real killers roam free and often kill again. These are enormous injustices, and I've yet to find a cop or a prosecutor with the spine to admit they blew it. This case is a bit different because those responsible for Quincy's wrongful conviction are gone. You can be the hero.
I'm not interested in being a hero. I just cannot justify spending the time. Believe me, I've got enough to worry about.
Sure you do. But you can cooperate and make my job easier. I'm just searching for the truth here, Sheriff.
I don't know. Let me think about it.
That's all I ask. For now, anyway.
He takes a deep breath, still unconvinced and definitely uncommitted to the cause.
Anything else?
Well, there is one other matter, another possible piece of the puzzle. Are you familiar with the death of Kenny Taft? Happened about 2 years after the murder.
Sure. He was the last officer killed on duty. His photo is hanging on the wall out there.
I'd like to see the case file without having to go through the Freedom of Information Act and all that crap.
And you think it was somehow related to Quincy Miller?
I doubt it. But I'm just digging, Sheriff. That's what I do. And there are always surprises along the way.
Let me think about it.
Thanks.
The fire chief is a pot-bellied, grizzled old veteran who goes by Lieutenant Jordan and is not nearly as friendly as the sheriff. Things are slow around the firehouse 2 blocks off Main Street. 2 of his men polish a shiny pumper in the driveway, and inside an ancient secretary fiddles with paperwork on her desk. Jordan eventually appears, and after a brief round of forced pleasantries, leads me to a cramped room with banks of 1940s-style file cabinets. For a moment, he searches through history and finds the drawer for 1988. He opens it, flips through a row of dingy files, finds what I'm after, and pulls it out.
Not much of a fire, as I recall,
he says as he places it on the table.
Help yourself.
He leaves the room. Back then, the sheriff's office was several blocks away in an old building that has since been razed. In Ruiz County, as in hundreds of other places, it was not at all unusual to store crime scene evidence anywhere there happened to be an empty space or closet. I've crawled through courthouse attics and suffocating basements in search of old records. To alleviate the shortage of storage space, Fitzner used a portable shed behind his office. In the file, there is a black-and-white photo of it before the fire, and a heavy padlock on the only door is visible. There were no windows. I estimate it was 30 feet long, 12 feet wide, 8 feet in height. A photo taken after the fire shows nothing but charred rubble. The first alarm came at 3:10 a.m., and the firemen found the shed fully engulfed. The fire was extinguished in a matter of minutes, with nothing salvageable. Its cause is listed as unknown. As Jordan said, it wasn't much of a fire. The flashlight found in Quincy's trunk was apparently destroyed. No trace was found. Conveniently, the autopsy reports, witness statements, diagrams, and photos were safely locked away inside Fitzner's desk. He had what he needed to convict Quincy Miller. For the moment, the fire is a dead end. Chapter 19. I call Carrie and Buck once a week to check on them. They realize I'm not going away and are slowly coming around.
I repeatedly assure her that she runs no risks by cooperating with me, and we establish a level of trust. We meet in a coffee shop near Kingsport and eat omelets. She reads the affidavit Maisie has prepared. Then Buck goes through it slowly. I answer the same questions about what happens next and so on, and after an hour of gentle cajoling, she signs it. In the parking lot, I give her a hug, and Buck wants one too. We're trusted pals now, and I thank them for having the courage to help Quincy. Through tears, she asks me to ask him to forgive her. "It's already done," I reply. My mother inherited the family farm near Dyersburg, Tennessee, my hometown. Mom is 73 and has lived by herself since Dad died 2 years ago. I worry about her because of her age, though she is healthier than me and not at all lonely. She worries about me because of my nomadic lifestyle and absence of a serious romantic relationship. She has grudgingly accepted the reality that starting a family is not one of my priorities, and I am not likely to produce more grandchildren. My sister has given her 3, but they live far away. She doesn't eat animals and is sustained by the land. Her garden is legendary and could feed hundreds, and in fact, does. She hauls baskets of fresh fruits and vegetables to the local food bank. We dine on tomatoes stuffed with rice and mushrooms, thick butter beans, and a squash casserole. In spite of the abundance, she eats like a bird and drinks nothing but tea and water. She is fit and spry and refuses to take pills, and as she pushes her vegetables around her plate, she encourages me to eat more. She is concerned about my lack of weight, but I wave her off. I hear this from others. Afterwards, we sit on the front porch and drink mint tea. Little has changed on the porch since my convalescence many years ago, and we talk about those dark days. We also talk about Brooke, my ex. They were fond of each other and kept in touch for years. Mom was angry with her at first for leaving me during my breakdown, but I finally convinced her that our split had been inevitable on our wedding day. Brooke married an entrepreneur who has done well. They have 4 children, beautiful teenagers, and Mom gets a bit wistful when she thinks about what might have been. As soon as I get an opening, I move the conversation in another direction. In spite of my unconventional lifestyle, Mom is proud of what I do, though she understands little about the criminal justice system. She finds it depressing that there is so much crime, so many people imprisoned, so many broken families. It has taken me years to convince her that there are thousands of innocent people locked away. This is our first chance to talk about Quincy Miller, and she loves getting the details. A murdered lawyer, a crooked sheriff, a drug cartel, an innocent man perfectly framed. She can't believe it at first and relishes the story. I don't worry about telling her too much. We are, after all, sitting on a dark porch in rural Tennessee, far away from Florida, and who would she tell anyway? I can trust my mom to keep secrets. We go through each of my other clients. Shasta Briley on death row in North Carolina, convicted of arson that killed her 3 daughters. Billy Rayburn in Tennessee, convicted by the dubious science of what has become known as the shaken baby syndrome after he tripped and fell while holding his girlfriend's baby. Duke Russell, still on death row in Alabama. Curtis Wallace, convicted in Mississippi of the abduction, rape, and murder of a young woman he never met, and little Jimmy Flagler, who was 17 and mentally retarded when Georgia locked him away for life. These 6 cases are my life and career. I live with them every day, and I often tire of thinking and talking about them. I ease the conversation back to Mom and ask how her poker game is going. She plays once a week with a group of lady friends, and though the stakes are small, it's cutthroat competition. She's currently up $11.50. They settle their debts at Christmas with a party where they break bad and consume alcohol. Cheap champagne. With another group, she plays bridge twice a month, but she prefers poker. She is in two book clubs, one with church ladies and they stick to theology, and the other with looser friends who prefer popular fiction. Sometimes even trash. She teaches a Sunday school class, reads to seniors at a retirement home, and volunteers with more nonprofits than she can name. She just bought an electric car and explains in detail what makes it run. Several times each year, Frankie Tatum stops by for dinner. They are close friends, and she loves cooking for him. He was here last week, and she talks about his visit. She is quite proud of the fact that he would still be locked away if not for me. This shifts the conversation back to my work. At one time, she wanted me to get through this phase and move on to a more sustainable career, maybe in a real law firm, but those conversations are over. Her pensions provide a comfortable life. She does not do debt, and she sends Guardian a small check each month. She goes to bed promptly at 10 o'clock and sleeps for 8 uninterrupted hours. She leaves me on the porch with a kiss on the head, and I sit wide-eyed for hours on this cool, quiet night and think of my clients sleeping on cramped bunks and cots behind bars. Innocent people. Chapter 20. Acting on a tip, the guards raided Zeke Huffy's cell a month ago and found a shank, a homemade knife. Drugs are routinely found in raids and are dealt with casually. But a weapon is a serious offense because it is such a threat to the guards. Zeke is spending time in the cave, an underground unit used to punish offenders with solitary confinement. His dreams of being paroled early are gone. Instead, he'll serve additional time. I'm met at a front office by a man in a suit, a deputy warden of some variety, and along with a guard, I'm whisked through security and led to a building away from the prisoners' units. The deputy warden nods and frowns, and doors open immediately. The right strings are being pulled. I walk down some concrete stairs and into a square, damp, windowless room. Zeke is waiting in a metal chair with leg irons locked to the floor. There is no partition between us. His hands are free, and after a momentary shock of seeing me, he offers a limp handshake. When the guard leaves and slams the door, Zeke asks, "What are you doing here?" "I'm here for a visit, Zeke. I've missed you." He grunts and can't think of a response. Residents of the cave are not allowed visitors. I pull out a pack of cigarettes and ask, "Want to smoke?" "Hell yes," he says. Suddenly the addict again. I hand him one and notice his shaking hands. I light it with a match. He closes his eyes and sucks hard in a mighty effort to consume it with one fierce pull. He blows a cloud of smoke at the ceiling and hits it again. After three, he flicks ashes on the floor and manages a smile.
"How'd you get in here, Post? This hole is off limits."
"I know. Got a friend down in Little Rock." He burns it down to the filter, thumps the butt against the wall, says,
"How about another one?"
I light another cigarette. He is pale and gaunt, even thinner than the last time I saw him, and he has a new tattoo across his throat. The nicotine comes